If this land is your land, then maybe it's time to rediscover your own backyard. And if your last road trip was as a youngster in the back of the family station wagon, then I'd suggest it's time to see for yourself the variety of great experiences you can have virtually anywhere in North America. And this year, we have the added bonus of celebrating the 150th birthday of Canada. The inspiration you need for finding your own favorite places is likely to be found in Patricia Schultz's latest book, 1,000 Places to See Before You Die in the U.S. and Canada. It's just been revised in its third edition. Patricia, thanks for being with us.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
In your latest book, you open with a quote by G.K. Chesterton. I want to read the quote, and it just really is a great way to start the book. The whole object of travel is not to set foot in a foreign land. It is at last to set foot in one's own country as a foreign land. That's a great way to start a book about traveling in your own country. Why does that resonate with you?
I think to open your eyes and your head with the same awe and awareness that you feel when you're removed from the comfort bubble of your own town or country or comfort zone. The first way you felt when, you know, you arrive in Asia, or the first time maybe in your 20s when you're backpacking through Europe, to feel that all of your senses are on, you know, in high mode and everything is unique and everything is new and it's a kind of wow moment time and again. And to not just feel like it's a rather ho-hum, okay, let's do, you know, let's get the kids in the car. No, I mean, it really should be seen for as the same way that, you know, that Japanese family that's come from the other side of the globe is experiencing one of our national parks the same way that you are, you know, with that same appreciation that here is truly something remarkable.
You've authored 1,000 Places to See Before You Die and 1,000 Places to See in United States and Canada Before You Die. A lot of people might say, there's a big difference between seeing and really experiencing. I mean, of course, there's more to travel than having a bucket list and checking things off. What are your words of caution for people who have a long list of things to see?
I think that my suggestions are probably what anyone would offer, and that is to not rush, to be in the moment, to really, you know, absorb, to immerse yourself, to not worry about the whole bragging rights, kind of ticking it off that sometimes notorious bucket list when, in fact, that is the only thing that's driving you to see all of these wonders, whether in North America or elsewhere. Mm-hmm. And to me, that word appreciation comes back time and again because it does have you stop and think and ponder and explore. How did it get here? What's its history? What is the heritage behind this? Who built it? Why is it in our textbooks? Why has it been overlooked? Why am I the only one here? Or why am I one of legions? Because, you know, all of these great iconic places often will, you know, if you think you're going to be the only one on Ellis Island, then you should stay home. So, but just an appreciation for everything that's in this book. And, you know, are these the only 1,000 places to see, whether in the World Book or the USA and Canada book? That's almost laughable because, you know, the more you travel, the more you understand that it's often all the stuff you stumble upon along the way.
I always have a longer list of things I want to see when I come home from a trip than when I left, because
I know,
as soon as you turn one corner, you find, oh, there's more. You've got a lot of new places listed in your Canada and the United States book, and you wrote that you were pleasantly surprised in particular by a couple of places, the Cowboy Poetry Gathering in Lewiston, Montana.
It's so reflective of that area of the world, of the U.S., and it's a gathering of cowboys and would-be cowboys, cowboy wannabes. I mean, the audience it attracts is often as interesting as the event itself. And there are a lot of these festivals that happen annually that are sometimes off the radar and sometimes deservingly on the radar because they are so unique and they are so endemic almost to that particular area. And, you know, for an East Coaster or a, you know, cosmopolitan big city gal, this whole cowboy thing, that it even still exists in America and is not something relegated to, you know, the old John Wayne movies, fascinates me. And there, you know, it's not just for tourism purposes. It's very much heartfelt and it's very much authentic. I hate to use that word, but it's just so appropriate here.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Patricia Schultz. Her book is, she's written 1,000 Places to See Before You Die, and also 1,000 Places to See in the United States and Canada Before You Die. Our phone number is 877-333-7425, and Kay's calling in from Folsom in California. Kay, thanks for your call.
Hi, Rick and Patricia.
Yeah.
Hi there.
I have a specific question for you, Patricia. I find that as I travel over the years and find places that I just love, I'm always in a quandary about, do I go to those so many places on my bucket list that I haven't been to yet, or do I go back to places that I've loved that I'd like to explore a little bit more and find out more about, go a little bit deeper under the surface? How do you make that decision?
Oh, that's a really tough one, and so pertinent, because when you talk about books of this size that, you know, kind of open up the realization that the possibilities are legion and countless, it gives me, to be quite honest, a sense of anxiety, because I so want to see it all. And I'm just so aware that time is precious, not just because there's no guarantee that we're going to be here, not even tomorrow, but, you know, tonight, this afternoon, 5 minutes from now. But also because if, you know, you're most of America that's working from Monday to Friday, and in my case, you know, 8 days a week, you just don't have that luxury of time. So you do need to be selective and you do need to be careful. And I guess it depends on your character and how what you enjoy most, because that's a kind of slow travel where you go and you really delve into beyond what is obvious for the immediate drive-by tourist to see. But I am quite different in my own personality is kind of you hit the ground running and you don't stop until you're back in the car, or back in your seat on the plane. So I guess it depends on, you know, what you enjoy most, because it is vacation. It is your special time to take a break from, you know, the tribulations and the reality of the same old, to, you know, break away and get out there and explore and see and do. And how you best enjoy it is only really for you to answer. So good luck. I probably haven't answered your question at all.
You know, one thing I find is very important, Kay, is to recognize that, you know, we Americans have about the shortest vacations in the rich world. And it's really important to recognize you can't see it all on any particular trip, and we shouldn't try to. We should be thankful that we'll always go home wishing we could have seen more, because it gives us more things to dream about and do on our next trip. So, Kay, thanks for your call.
Thanks for taking my call.
Hey, Patricia, one thing you also were pleasantly surprised by in your new edition was the Dallas State Fair. Tell us about that.
Oh, I'm a sucker for a great state fair, and they certainly know how to throw a state fair. It's everything on a stick. It's great people watching, great for families, 2-3 generations, a lot of cowboy hats, a lot of big eating going on, great, you know, star-studded concerts and music venues and line dance. It's just so wonderfully, it's like everything you ever wanted to experience about Texas in one visit to the state.
And also, you know, your book is United States and Canada. You mentioned seeing polar bears in Churchill, Manitoba. What was that like?
Oh, that's remarkable. And also Canada in 2017. I hope that in the U.S. we come to understand that there's lots going on, because it's their 150th anniversary. So, for example, all of their national parks are free and you can really save a lot of money. Mm. And what an incentive to see some of their parks that are every bit as beautiful as our most beautiful. The polar bears are way up north of Manitoba, and Manitoba is one of their provinces that doesn't get a phenomenal amount of tourism. It shares a border partially with North Dakota. But if you go north to Hudson Bay, in September, October, when hundreds of polar bears wander down to the coastline, waiting for the ice floes to form so they can go off to sea and eat, you'll see them on shore, and it's pretty spectacular. And there are northern lights if you go in October, so it's like a double whammy.
What's your favorite bit in the far east of Canada, the Maritimes and so on?
I love those Maritime provinces. They're pretty spectacular. There is Prince Edward Island. To me, probably Cape Breton Island, part of Nova Scotia, with that wonderful classic drive, the John Cabot Drive, I believe, along the coastline, and a lot of old Scottish, Irish heritage. festivals, music, and it looks very much like the old country. Mm-hmm. I can see when the Scots and the Irish arrived, they felt quite at home and probably still do to this day. Newfoundland also is really kind of on the radar in the last year or three or five.
Rachel from Davis, California is on the line with a comment about Canadian travel. Rachel, thanks for your call.
Yes. I was asking a question about the best time to travel in Canada with the Rocky Mountain train.
Oh, it's beautiful in the autumn time, as you can imagine. And they actually are seasonal, so they will determine just when you travel. They have select departures in the winter months in December, January, when it's beautiful to see the Rockies covered by snow. In fact, that's when I went with VIA, which is the national railroad. But they don't run year-round. They're popular, of course, in the summertime as well. I would say in the autumn time, but it's also the most popular probably because the departures are limited, so you'd need to book way in advance. But you can imagine the beauty in the autumn time, except that the Rockies are a lot of evergreens and conifers, so that not everything changes color as you would expect, but it is still warmer weather, and it is still beautiful, I think. The Rocky Mountain area in Alberta and British Columbia and Canada is just second to none.
So is this a train that's like a tour train, or is it just a regular transportation train?
No, it's for tourism exclusively, and they have glass-domed cars, and you eat on board. In the evening, they escort you to a hotel, and they're usually short range, like one or two nights only. Mm. I think they're a few longer, but you don't sleep on the train because they don't have the facilities.
That sounds like, I love Banff and Jasper. Thanks for your call.
Okay, thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Rachel.
Patricia, is there one place in particular that has impacted your personal feelings about our environment?
That's a very good question. I suppose that what we were just talking about, you know, the Arctic, and we, you know, travel in general wherever you go in the world and at whatever time is such an education. I like to call it, you know, the classroom without walls. And what I learned about climate change that is so visible and so immediately in your face, obvious when you travel to the northern latitudes, seeing what were in some cases skeletal polar bears because their habitat is changing so radically and so quickly. So all throughout the Arctic, I think that's immediately noticeable and very much like heart penetrating because you can see it there everywhere.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Patricia Schultz about her thoughts after updating her book, A Thousand Places to See in the United States and Canada Before You Die. Patricia, as you travel around the United States, tell me a place or two where you really enjoy the history. Where does the history really become vivid for you?
Oh, to me, I think there's truly, without exception, I exaggerate, and I think that New Orleans is our most un-American and yet quintessentially American city that just oozes with history. I think that Chicago is architecturally and visually a magnificent city.
I just took an architecture tour of the skyline.
Aren't they fascinating?
It was wonderful. And I took a Segway tour all along the lakefront in Chicago. And what a, just physically a brilliant city. Also, where do you get a general appreciation for the brilliance of our founding fathers?
Well, Philadelphia, to me, I took a walking tour, and I kind of realized for not the first time that I must have slept through American history in school, because what I learned in those 2 hours, the guy just couldn't talk fast enough.
It's great to go back as an adult when you're really an eager student and you realize this is worth knowing, and Philadelphia would be the place then. Where do you get an appreciation of the tragedy of the Civil War?
You know, for one recent July 4th weekend, we decided at the last minute to drive, which is not difficult from New York, to drive to Gettysburg in Pennsylvania. And I thought it would be kind of staged and, you know, a little uncomfortably hokey, but it was brilliantly done. Mm. And the Civil War buffs who come from all over America to reenact the battle, it was the single bloodiest battle in the Civil War. Everybody dresses in costume in Civil War era wear. Mm-hmm. And we did a tour with one of the National Park Rangers. It's one of our great military battlefield national parks. fascinating to me. And again, when you learn it in the three-dimensional, in the, you know, when you go back as an adult and you learn because you want to and not because you have to, and you're not learning it from a dusty old textbook, but from the actual in situ place, I think that's a remarkable place for all generations and a great family destination to bring the kids and have them learn and have them appreciate.
In my travels lately, I've noticed how there's a lot of great cities that have had neighborhoods that were run down and dangerous, and now they're gentrified and vibrant. And I was just in Boston, and there's whole areas now that are just lively that used to be no-go zones. The same thing in other cities. You've been at this for a long time now with your 1,000 places to see before you die. What is your observation of the city core, urban America? Do you see it changing in the last 10, 15 years that you've been working? What are some examples?
You know, the first thing that came to mind when you were talking about different neighborhoods, et cetera, was Detroit. I went, well, the first time in an awfully long time, about 2 or 3 years ago, with one of the born and raised old school Detroiters who refuses to leave and is very much involved in this grassroots kind of derelict house by derelict house. I'm attempting to save or salvage what once was a magnificent city, because incredible museums and incredible history, and the outlying areas, you know, have stayed pretty much intact, but how they're trying to resuscitate this city that's at the edge of, you know, destitution. In New York City, for example, you don't need to go very far. The new place now is Queens, because Brooklyn has become so regentrified that it's now more expensive to live in certain areas of Brooklyn than it is in Midtown Manhattan.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Patricia Schultz about the new edition of her book, 1,000 Places to See in the United States and Canada Before You Die. I noticed Charleston, South Carolina, has like 6 entries in your book. Talk a little bit about Charleston or some other small town that really has that delightful old world charm.
Well, Charleston, while it really exudes that smaller city ambiance character, is quite a large city and quite a thrumming city, and was very, very important to America in the early years. And all of our plantation and agricultural wealth in the plantations outside of downtown Charleston fed that city with incredible money and coffers that built antebellum architecture that is there and preserved, and you can stay overnight in these inns, or they house perhaps the earliest museum from the 1800s in Charleston as well, and restaurants, what an incredible eating scene as well, and just delightful and beautiful. But I would not go there in July and August, because it's like 100,000 degrees on a cool day. But in the springtime, it's magnolias and azaleas, and they open a lot of these private antebellum homes, which sometimes are in the same family generations and generations later, and they open them in the springtime to the public and in the autumn time to the public, and their gardens, their private gardens as well.
We can all put that on our list. Patricia Schultz, thanks for all your work, and best wishes with the new edition of 1,000 Places to See in the United States and Canada Before You Die. Happy travels.
Thank you very much, Rick. Same to you.
All right.
This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island. From the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream water. This land was made for you and me.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced by Tim Tatton, Sarah McCormick, and Isaac Kaplan-Wilner at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington. Thanks to the Radio Foundation in New York for studio help this week. Find out how you can talk to Rick's tour guide friends from Europe and beyond an upcoming edition of the show. Look in the radio section of ricksteves.com.